So we are live. just in case you want to hide anything. All right. Welcome back, everybody. It's good to be back, at least on my side. It's good to be back here and back into things. So this term, we're going to continue on with Course of Jewish Essentials, CJE in brief, an overview of Jewish history. That's the module which we're going to do this term. It's 9 weeks. So just before we begin, you have in front of you two handouts. One of them we're not really going to reference to. It's just I want you to have it. It says course plan. So basically, I just wrote down over here the objective of what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to gain a general understanding of what happened throughout Jewish history and when it happened, and to gain an insight into monumental events which shaped Jewish history, to understand at least the primary main events which really not only impacted us then, but impact us now and shape the course of Jewish history. I've divided it into four stages. I'm not really going to do it like that, but just if you want to summarize it in your mind, the entire Jewish history, so you can, this is just my own division, it's not based on anything, but you can do it from Abraham, the first Jew, till the first time going into Israel. That includes the patriarchs, the matriarchs, Egypt, Mount Sinai, the desert, etc. Basically, the first five books of the Chumash, five books of the Torah. You have the first entry into Israel till the destruction of the first temple, including Babylonian exile. There you have Joshua, the conquest of Israel, prophets, kings, split of the Jewish kingdom, the rise of Babylonian Empire, the holiday of Purim, etc. Then we have the Second Temple till the destruction of the Second Temple. It's the Greek Empire, Hanukkah, the rise of the Roman Empire, Jewish revolt, including the rise of various religions, other religions, which of course impacted Jewish history. And then we have our exile till today, which includes Talmud, Crusades, Spanish Inquisition, pogroms, Holocaust, and all the way till the State of Israel. So that's the entire 9 weeks in 1 minute. Now, obviously, when we want to do an overview of Jewish history, it's impossible to do it in 9 weeks. Every event that we discuss, we can spend an entire week discussing. It could take you years, really, to go through every single detail of Jewish history. Even if you want to do a general overview properly, it should take you a full year at least. But the purpose over here really is just to get a very general overview. Just a general understanding of what happened when and really the monumental events of Jewish history. And we'll soon discuss why, like what the purpose of that is. So in this handout you have over here, I've put over here a much more detailed timeline than what we're going to go through. We'll go through some of these things, but quite a detailed timeline from the creation of the world till our very day in terms of Jewish history. And you have over here two ways of counting it, of course. You have the Jewish year, and you have the secular year, which a lot of it is BCE, right, before Common Era, and then you have afterwards. So that's this. We're not going to reference to it. Just if you want to go back and see it and put everything that we discussed into proper perspective and everything, you can go back there. What we're going to focus on is the other handout, which we're going to focus on today is from Abraham till the first entry into the land of Israel. So the truth is that what we're going to learn today, most of you probably know most of it because it's very basic, you know, about our patriarchs, matriarchs, Egypt, the giving of the Torah. So what I want to do today is go through those events, but give some perspective more than actually just what happened. Because what happened, I think we all know more or less the story of going out of Egypt. We more or less know the story of the Jewish people going through the desert. I'll go through it quickly, but we'll just try to go through more perspective. And also how a lot of these events weren't just events, but they actually shaped the entire course of Jewish history. So before we begin, we first need to discuss why learn about history at all? Why is history important? At first glance, what happened, it's a nice story. Why is history so important? So there's a saying that goes like this, that, oh sorry, just before I continue, just before, a lot of what I'm going to talk about in terms of history, I'm not a historian, I'm not very good at history, so I'm obviously basing it off other sources. I'm going to be basing it on a Jewish history crash course given by Rabbi Spiro. I think that's how I pronounce his name, Rabbi Spiro. It's printed on aish.com. So that's very, he goes through everything. I'm not going to go through everything he goes through, but a lot of what I'm saying is based on his writings. So just for honesty's sake. Okay. So there's a number of answers to that question. Why learn about history? So there's a saying, history is a philosophy with examples, which means that when you learn history, we see what's right, what's wrong, what works, what doesn't work, which ideas made the world a better place, which ideas made the world a terrible place. And as the famous saying goes, those who cannot remember history are destined to repeat it. Right? If we don't look back at what worked and what didn't work, and what specifically regarding the Jewish people, what the Jewish people did right and what the Jewish people did wrong, we won't have the proper perspective on how we are supposed to live our lives. Right? We learn history, and we see what happened. We can look back and see where they failed and where they did good things, and emulate that. As it says in the pasuk, and you have this in front of you, in your handout. This is a pasuk from in Parshas Ha'azinu, in the second to last parsha in the Torah. It says, Zachor yimois olam, remember the days of old. Binu shnois doir vadoir, consider the years of many generations. Sha'al avicha v'yageitcha, ask your father and he will tell you. Zekeinecha, your elders, v'yoymru lach, and they will tell you. In other words, the concept of always looking back to the previous generations and asking them to tell us their story so we can know what's right and what's wrong. But more specifically, when it comes to Jewish history, there's another very important reason, and much deeper, and that is that Jewish history only works and only makes sense when you have God as part of that history, as we'll soon illustrate. But there has to be a God which orchestrated this history. And when we look at the history, we get a certain sense of what did God want with the creation of the world? What was the purpose of creation? When we look at Jewish history and we look through a lot of things which happened, we'll see a sort of a direction into why God created the world at all. And what are we doing here on planet Earth? What is our mission? So it's not just about what's right and what's wrong, but it's a general perspective. The purpose of creation comes out throughout Jewish history. And that's why it's so deep and so important to understand properly Jewish history. So that's why before we actually begin with Jewish history, we need to spend a few minutes discussing the history of the world, which will then give us a certain context into where Judaism appeared and to what type of world Judaism began. Namely, Abraham, who was the first Jew, the founder of Judaism, really. In what type of world was he born, and at which point of time was he born? So Abraham was born in the year 1948. That's the Jewish year, 1948, 1813 BCE. That means that 1,948 years before that, the world was created. Right? We have a belief the world was created 5,777 years ago. How to reconcile that with science is a totally different topic, and it's a good topic, maybe we'll get there one day. But anyway, that's the Jewish belief. And God created the world with a purpose that this world, this physical mundane world, should be a home for godliness, that God should be able to be felt and able to be revealed in the world. And God created the world perfect. God created a perfect world. He put Adam and Eve, the first people, first man and woman, in a perfect place, in Gan Eden, in paradise. And they were created to serve God in this utopian atmosphere, in this Gan Eden, in this perfect world in paradise, and they would obey God and listen to God and serve God. Right. However, it didn't quite end up that way. Because, of course, on the first day that they were created, 3 hours after they were created, they sinned. They ate from the Eitz Hadas, the tree of knowledge, Adam and Eve. And that brought impurity into the world. And that's sort of totally threw the whole creation off course. Which isn't quite like that, because actually it says in many, we're not going to spend too much time on this, but it says in many sources that actually that was part of the plan. God didn't want the world just to be perfect automatically. He wanted us to make it perfect. So in other words, yes, he originally created a perfect world, but the fact that Adam and Eve sinned and then brought impurity upon the world was all part of the plan of creation, that then for the next thousands of years we should then work to remake the world a perfect place. And basically it was downhill from there. Human beings forgot about their creator. They forgot about God. Not only did they forget about God, that led to them forgetting about morality. And the world became a terrible, terrible place. A place of terrible sin and immorality, of murder and thievery and immorality in all areas of life. And that is what led to God to decide that basically he's going to destroy the world. Besides for one person and his family, Noach, and his family, who were the only righteous people in the entire generation, everybody else God is going to wipe out with, of course, the famous Great Flood, which happened 1,656 years after the world was created. Okay? And the purpose of the flood was to sort of wash the world, not only physically, but also spiritually cleanse the world, and then we can start again, and now the world can go and fulfill its purpose, to bring God into the world and make it a good place and make it into a perfect place. That didn't quite work out either, right? What happened after Noach came out of the Teva, after the flood, came out of the Ark? The world didn't become a perfect place. People started to serve idols once again. People left God and went to idolatry, right? And the world basically almost got as bad as it was before the flood. And God would have destroyed the world again, not through a flood, because he promised not to, but he would have basically almost, so to speak, give up on humanity if not for Abraham being born. Abraham being born is not just a monumental event for Jewish history. It's a monumental event for history, period. Abraham, it says, till Abraham came along, the world was walking in darkness. That's the expression that our sages use. When Abraham was born, hischil lahoir, light started to shine. He brought a new light into the world which was not there before. And Abraham was born, as we mentioned, in the year 1948 in the Jewish calendar. Right. Abraham discovers God at a very young age, the age of 3 years old, till about the age of 40, Maimonides tells us, and he thinks about who created the world. Everyone knows, he said who created the sun, maybe it was the moon, and he went through a whole calculation until he realized that there's one creator. And he stood up for those values, for those monotheistic values, to such an extent that he was willing to give up his life, as the famous story goes, that he smashed all the idols in his father's store, and Nimrod, who was the king at the time, basically the punishment for that was death, and he was willing to jump into the fire, and he jumped into the fire, and God saved him. Basically, he was going full force with this mission to bring monotheism, to bring the belief of one God into the world. He married his wife, Sarah, who was the mother of the Jewish people. And God decided that this couple is going to be the founders of Judaism. And that's why he told Abraham, pick yourself up, move away from your family, and go to Eretz Canaan. Go to the land of Canaan, which of course ended up becoming later Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. And it is there that God made a covenant with Abraham in the year 2018. Called the Bris Bein HaBesorim, the covenant, which in this covenant, God became intrinsically connected to the Jewish people. This is an incredibly monumental event in Jewish history. God became one with us and forever, and he can never break that covenant. He promised Abraham that he's going to have a great nation, and this great nation will end up inheriting the promised land, will end up inheriting the land of Israel. So this is an incredible event where God became connected to the Jewish people forever. Now, there's a lot we can talk about Abraham, and we don't have that much time to talk about him because there's so much more to talk about. But what's very important to talk about is how we see from what God told Abraham and from Abraham's personality a lot about the Jewish people. There's a lot about that we see that will go through Jewish history. We'll see it happening again and again that we already see in the first Jew that he encompassed all of these things. And we see it especially where God tells him, go away from your father's house and go to the land where I will show you. And let's just read the verse inside. You have it in front of you over here. Now the Lord said, this is very old English, old translation I found online. Anyway, but now he says, now the God said to Abraham, go out of your country, from your birthplace, from your father's house, into the land that I will show you. Right away you see over here an incredible characteristic of the Jewish people that we see throughout history. And that is the concept of going away from everybody else, meaning being different, and having the attitude of changing the world. There's something about a Jew, or about the Jewish people, that we feel this drive to change the world. You know, it's a fascinating thing. If you go through all the isms throughout, you know, the past 100 years, who were the people who were fighting at the head of all of them? By the way, not all of them were so good. For example, communism, right? The Jewish people. The Jewish people were the ones who were the heads of these things, right? Why? Because the Jewish people, starting from Abraham, have this inherent ambition to change the world. Now, we can either use that to change the world like Abraham wanted to change the world, to bring God to the world, belief in one God, or you can use that to bring terrible destruction to the world. But the fact is, we always have a very unique opinion about things, and we always want to, so to speak, change the world and change the course of humanity to go according to that opinion. And it all started from Abraham. Now, with Abraham, it was a very good thing that God gave him this mission: go away from your father's house, separate yourself from the ideology which you've been brought up with, and bring your message to the world. And that's an incredible thing. We see, where does he tell him to go? To the land which I will show you. And we're going to discuss this obviously more at length. But right away, at the very beginning, at the very foundation of Judaism, we see our connection to the land of Israel. One of the first things God tells him is you go to Eretz Canaan, go to the land of Israel. Judaism and the land of Israel go hand in hand. You cannot separate the two. Where Jewish people will ultimately fulfill their mission will be in the land of Israel. Because the land of Israel is a holy land. It's a land which is conducive to reveal godliness in it. And therefore, ultimately, where will the Jewish people, ultimately, meaning with the coming of Mashiach, when all the Jewish people will be in the land of Israel, there God will be revealed. That's a land which is created with holiness and created with an inherent appreciation for godliness. And therefore, right away at the beginning, we establish Israel belongs to the Jewish people. This is our land. This is what we're all about. And that's right away when Jewish people become a nation. So that's a very important statement that God tells Abraham. Another thing he tells him is like this, in verse 2. And I will make you a great nation. Before we get to what he will make us to, the very fact I will make, the fact that God, we mentioned briefly before, is a part of parcel of our history. It's important to realize, when we start learning about Jewish history, that our history does not make sense. It only makes sense because God is a part of it. It's totally supernatural. I'm not going to go through this, but you have at the back over here, I printed, from not Jewish sources. Unbelievable quotes from various professors and philosophers about the fact that the Jewish people still exist. And a lot of them basically are saying that it's supernatural. It's not natural. Starting off, by the way, from the birth of the second Jew, or the third Jew, let's say, after Abraham and Sarah, Yitzchak. Sarah was barren. She was unable to have children. It was impossible naturally for her to have children. In a supernatural way, she gave birth to Yitzchak. But of course, much more than that, we should have been exterminated, eradicated thousands of times. The fact that we were around close to 2,000 years without our own land, and we were dispersed amongst all the nations, and we still kept our identity, our unique identity, again, doesn't make any sense. There is no other nation like that. There is no other example for such a thing. The only explanation you can explain for that is God. The supernatural. I will make you into a great nation. The emphasis on I, on God. God is a part of Jewish history. Take away God, the whole Jewish history doesn't make any sense. So that's again a very important idea that God conveys to the first Jew. And then he says a very important point. I will bless you and make my name and make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And this is a very interesting thing. Judaism and Jewish people have been a blessing on humanity. We have, and it's also a very important point to understand about Jewish history, we have brought the values that we consider to be a given today, for example, a respect of life, the value of human life, all these type of things are values which come from the Jewish religion, that come from the Ten Commandments, come from monotheistic Abraham, who God gave, eventually God will give us that moral code, which won't only change the Jewish nation, but will change the world. Brought what we consider to be regular, normal things, our Torah, our values, is what brought that to the world. And that's a given thing. And I'll read you something interesting that I've quoted here from John Adams, the second president of the United States. And he says, "I will insist that the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. They are the most glorious nation to ever inhabit this earth. They have given religion to 3/4 of the globe and have influenced the affairs of mankind more and more happily than any other nation, ancient or modern." He wasn't Jewish, right? As far as I know, right? So just interesting to see even how he recognized such a thing, that it is Judaism has been a blessing on humanity. I will make you a blessing. And then there's a very important point, and this is something which we also see clearly. I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those that curse you. It is unbelievable, when you look at Jewish history, to see an unbelievable pattern. Jewish people arrive somewhere, that place welcomes them in, the place becomes an incredibly successful place. In olden, ancient times, could even be a world empire, and at the time that they banish the Jews and they get rid of the Jews and they start to kill Jews, etc., their empire falls. You see it with Egypt, you see it with Babylonia, you see it with Rome, you see it with the Greeks, you see it with Spain, you see it with Germany, you see it through every country on earth that has welcomed Jews into their society, that they have been blessed. All when they have subsequently banished Jews from their society, they have not been blessed, they have been cursed. And that's, again, very important to understand about Jewish history, what God told Abraham right at the beginning. And that's an unbelievable thing to realize. Right? Okay. The next thing that happens, well, again, there are many things that happen, but we're going to discuss the main thing. So, Abraham has a son, again, in a supernatural way, Isaac. Isaac is born in the year 2048. So, if you make a calculation, Abraham was 100 years old. Right? He was 100 years old, which obviously, again, was also supernatural. Yitzchak, one of the most monumental occasions of Yitzchak's life was, of course, the binding of Yitzchak, which happened in 2084. So Yitzchak, which is interesting to point, not everybody realizes this, when you learn the story of God telling Abraham to sacrifice his only son, you know, you think you're talking about a child. Yitzchak was almost 40 years old at the time. He was a grown man. He wasn't like a baby which Abraham took to sacrifice on the altar. He was a man with his own free will, and nevertheless he went along with it, which also is monumental, not only for him, but also for the entire Jewish nation, because that started a trend of self-sacrifice. Not literally to put yourself on an altar and sacrifice yourself, but the concept that a Jew is willing to go all the way for his Judaism, even if it means giving up one's life. And that's a trend started by Abraham and continued by Yitzchak with the binding of Isaac, the concept of Mesiras Nefesh, the concept of self-sacrifice, of being willing to give up anything and everything for our beliefs. Yitzchak, of course, very important point. That moment, the binding of Isaac, is when a few minutes later, literally, is when Sarah died. Which didn't happen to be that way. It was a direct cause, because it's a whole story. But when Sarah heard about it, basically, she heard that Yitzchak was being, because Abraham didn't tell her that God had, if you want to sacrifice your son, you better not tell your wife that you're about to do it. So he didn't tell her that he was going to do it. So she heard about it from somebody else. And then she heard that Abraham didn't end up sacrificing him, and she was so happy and so overwhelmed that actually her soul left her body, and she died. And it was then that Abraham purchased the cave of Machpelah, Moras HaMachpelah in Hebron, which is the reason why I mentioned this specific event is because obviously it's very timely. People, obviously with no basis, seem to question whether the cave of Machpelah should be in Jewish hands. It's just a fact of Jewish history that Abraham purchased it with money, literal purchase, for the sake of burying his wife there, and eventually he was buried there, and all our forefathers and our matriarchs, besides for Rachel, were buried there. So that obviously is a very important event. Okay, so Yitzchak has two sons, twins, Yaakov and Esav. Right? Yaakov is born in the year 2108, and when they become bar mitzvah, when they become 13 years old, Abraham dies, and then comes the story of Jacob buying the rights of the firstborn from Esav. Esav was the firstborn son, a twin, but firstborn, he was born first. And Esav walks in, and he sees Yaakov making lentils. Why was he making lentils? Lentils is a food traditionally given to mourners, because it's round. Mourners eat round things, represents the cycle of life. Yitzchak, at that day, was in mourning over the passing of Abraham. Therefore, Yaakov was making him lentils. Esav was very hungry. He says famous words, "Haliteini na mina adem adem azeh," like literally, like pour me from this red soup that you're making. Then he says, "Give it to me, like pour it down my throat." And Yaakov says, "No problem. Sell me the rights of the firstborn," which in Jewish history at that point meant the rights to bring sacrifices. Esav said, "What do I need it for?" And he sold it, which was very monumental, because that led to another event later on where Yaakov steals the blessings. Right? Yitzchak, the father of the twins, thinks that Esav is very righteous. He isn't. Esav is incredibly wicked. Rivka, Yaakov's mother, understands that Yaakov is the righteous one and he should get the blessings that Yitzchak will bestow. And the blessings didn't just mean blessings. It meant the Jewish legacy, the Jewish continuity through the next generation. And basically, when she overheard Yitzchak telling her son Esav, "I'm going to give you the blessings," she went and told Yaakov, "Quickly go and dress up like Esav," famous story, and he goes and steals the blessings. And what he basically tells, what Yitzchak basically tells Esav afterwards is that really, actually Yaakov was right, because he's the firstborn. Although you're physically the firstborn, but he bought the firstborn rights off you, and therefore he rightfully got those blessings. So that was a very important, the fact that he got those blessings were also very important. That happened in the year 2171. Okay. Yaakov, our forefather, has 12 sons. 12 sons and one daughter, Dinah. And here, and again, there's a lot happens over here. He goes to his father-in-law's house, Lavan, many, many details, but we're going to focus on one point of here, which leads us to further on in history. And that is the story that eventually led the Jewish people into Eretz Mitzrayim, into the land of Egypt. God had told Abraham that your children will be strangers in a land which does not belong to them. And that was going to happen for whatever reason. God decreed, there are various reasons given. One of the explanations is that it was a sort of a purification process. The Jewish people, before they go to Mount Sinai and receive the Torah, before they go to Mount Sinai and receive the Torah, they have to go through this purification process of suffering, and they went and they spent 210 years in Egypt, like we'll see soon. But how did they land in Egypt? The Jewish people were in Eretz Canaan, they were in Israel. How did they land in the land of Egypt? So here we have the whole story of, if by the way, I go through something quickly and you're not sure of what I'm saying, please interrupt me. I have no problem going into something more at length if you want me to. He had 12 sons, as I said before. But his favorite son was Joseph. Why was he his favorite son? Because when Yaakov Avinu wanted to get married, he wanted to marry Rachel. However, Rachel's father tricked Yaakov into marrying the older daughter, Leah. Right? And what happened was that Yaakov, this is the way the verse describes it, obviously we need to give more insight into this story, because when we're talking about people like Yaakov, great people, there's obviously more depth to this. But I'm just going to say the way the literal story happens, he loves Rachel, that was his intended wife. He ended up marrying her also. And what God does is he makes Rachel barren and gives children to Leah. And Leah has six sons. But Rachel remains childless until eventually Rachel gives birth to a son called Joseph, called Yosef. And Yaakov has this special love for him because it's his firstborn son from his most beloved life, from his most beloved wife. Right? And what happens is that the brothers get jealous. But they sense that Yosef is more loved. And Yosef comes and starts telling them about his dreams. They have this dream that, eventually all of you will bow down to me. I had this dream that the sun, the moon, and the stars were all bowing down to me. And 11 stalks of wheat were bowing down to me. And they took it as if he wants to rule over them. And they got incredibly jealous. Eventually what happened is they wanted to kill him. The firstborn son, Reuven, convinced them out of that plan because he said, I'll be responsible for this. Let's throw him into a pit. Throw him into a pit and we'll see what happens there. Eventually what happens is Reuven actually goes away for a few minutes or whatever it is. And during that time, some Arab merchants pass by. And they sell Yosef to those Arab merchants as a slave. And they take Yosef down to Egypt. Okay, and that the fact that Yosef landed in Egypt was all part of God's plan. It was all to get Yaakov there with his family. How did that happen? So Yosef is there for many years. And Yosef's experience there is a very Jewish experience, actually. Again, very tells us a lot about Jewish history. He comes there the lowest of the low. He comes there as a slave. What happens? He gets sold to a man by the name of Potiphar. Once he's there, he rises to the top. Typical, he comes in charge, he runs Potiphar's household, right? And what happens then? What happens when the Jew reaches the top? Someone is going to bring them down. Right? That's the course of Jewish history. We go up and then we go down. What happens? Potiphar's wife takes a liking to Yosef. She tries to seduce him. Yosef refuses. And to get back at him, she screams, she claims that he wanted to rape her. What happens? Yosef lands in prison. So again, he's down in the depths. He's in the dungeon, he's in the prison, he's in Mitzrayim, far away from home. He's abandoned. What happens? In prison, there are two people who have dreams. He interprets their dreams. They're the butler and the baker of King Pharaoh. Eventually, the butler gets out of prison. 2 years later, Pharaoh has dreams, doesn't know the interpretation of them, and the butler remembers, oh, we have an interpreter of dreams, bring him out of prison. Yosef comes, and he interprets the dreams to mean that it's going to be 7 years of plenty in Egypt, followed by 7 years of terrible, terrible famine. So Pharaoh asks him, what should we do? So he says, a great idea, for the 7 years of plenty, let's stock up on food and storehouses that will have enough to satisfy us during the 7 years of famine. Pharaoh says, this guy's a smart guy. He puts him in charge of everything in Egypt, makes him second in command. So he goes from, again, being down in the dungeon to suddenly being the second greatest person in Egypt. Again, a very, very Jewish experience over here, right? The famine gets so bad, it reaches the land of Israel, and there's no food. So Yaakov sends his 12 sons, or 11 sons now, actually 10, because he left his youngest one at home because he was scared what was going to happen to him, down to Egypt. And Yosef recognizes them. They don't recognize Yosef. And this is a whole drama that the Torah describes at length. He first accuses them of being spies. He's mean to them. He's nice to them. He wants to see if they've repented, if they'll stand up for their brother's sake. He takes one of them as prisoners. Anyway, eventually what happens is it leads up to the point where Yosef reveals himself to his son, to his brothers, and says, is my father still alive? Bring him down to Egypt. This is what led to Yaakov Avinu coming down to Egypt. Yaakov Avinu comes down to Egypt. Altogether, the Jewish people, grand total, 70 people. That's the entire Jewish nation. 70 people. This happened in the year 2238. The Jewish people arrive in Egypt. Jewish people arrive in Egypt. Egypt welcomes them with open arms. For sure, come in. Again, a very typical Jewish experience. Right? They're welcomed. What happens? Joseph dies. Joseph dies in the year 2309. Shortly after that, in 2332, slavery begins. What led to slavery beginning? What led to slavery beginning was classic anti-Semitism. What happened? The Jewish people began to multiply in unbelievable numbers. The Torah describes that 6 babies were born at once, and it was literally became overwhelmingly an unbelievable amount of Jews all of a sudden. Suddenly, the Egyptians are getting worried. Now, the Jews are law-abiding citizens. They're not trying to take over Egypt. They're not bothering anybody. They're keeping to their own corner in the land of Goshen. They're not trying to change anything. They're great people. But somehow, Paro is suspecting them that one day they're going to get so great, they're going to conquer us and overpower us. This is baseless hatred, which is the base of most anti-Semitism. The Jews are taking over the world. They're trying to control everything, right? Even though, whatever, generally speaking, Jews are good citizens. I'm sure there are some Jews which aren't, but I'm saying, generally speaking, as a whole, as a population, we're not out there to, you know, rebel against governments and topple countries and conquer people, right? But that was Paro's fear. And because of that, he made a decree, let's kill every single Jewish baby boy. That's how it started off. And eventually it led to slavery starting. The Jewish people sink to an incredible, incredible low, not only physically, but also spiritually. They almost lose their identity. That's the way the Rambam, Maimonides, describes this experience. He says that Abraham's legacy was almost lost. Now, with everything that was the Jewish people, okay, started off with 70 people, that whole massive novelty that Abraham brought to the world was about to be lost. The Jewish people started to serve idols. They totally forgot about their whole mission on this earth. And at that point, Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Moshe Rabbeinu was born in year 2368. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses being born, is of course monumental. Moshe Rabbeinu will later become the redeemer of the Jewish people, the leader of the Jewish people. And eventually, God speaks to Moshe, his first direct by the burning bush, famous story, tells him, go take the Jewish people out of Egypt. But by the way, Moshe Rabbeinu was brought up in Paro's house. It's a very ironic story. It's like the one who wanted to annihilate the Jewish people actually brought up the one who saved the Jewish people. It's just very interesting how history plays out, right? And again, I'm not going to get into this story in great detail because we know it, and the truth is it's a separate shir. But of course, Moshe Rabbeinu comes back to Egypt. He tells Paro, let my people go. Paro doesn't listen. He brings 10 plagues. Egypt is basically shattered. And finally, in the year 2448, 210 years after the Jewish people came down to Egypt in the year 2238, the Jewish people were freed from Egypt. The Jewish people going out of Egypt wasn't just them being saved from slavery. It was, in a way, the birth of the Jewish people. That was when the Jewish people went out together. They went for the purpose of going to Mount Sinai to receive the Torah. And at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, at the time of going out of Egypt, we received the gift of freedom. We became a free people, and we became intrinsically free that no matter what happens, we will always remain free. Even in the darkest times, even the worst times in Jewish history, Jewish people have always retained their distinct identity and their beliefs, at least as a whole. Obviously, individuals, not always, but at least as a whole, we've kept our identity strong because we're intrinsically free. Nobody can control now our spiritual destiny. They might be able to control our physical bodies, but they can never now control our spiritual destiny. The Jewish people go out of Egypt. What's the first thing that happens? They run out of food. Also a very Jewish experience, right? They're hungry. They need food. They complain to God. God brings down the man, the heavenly bread. And this also, by the way, is an interesting point in history because that is when Moshe Rabbeinu composed the first blessing of Birkat HaMazon, of benching. You know, we recite the after blessing after we eat bread. The first blessing is that Moshe Rabbeinu composed at this point as a blessing to God for giving us the man, the heavenly bread. They also don't have water, and they ended up getting water, and at that point, they get the mitzvah of Shabbos. Mitzvah of Shabbos is a very special mitzvah, unique mitzvah, given to them before the Torah was given. Then, they travel, and they arrive at Mount Sinai. The giving of the Torah, of course, I skipped out the splitting of the sea and all that. That's all part of the Exodus. The giving of the Torah, which was obviously in the same year, was 49 days after the Exodus in the year 2448, is, if one can say, the most monumental event in Jewish history. And we've been through this number of times in various shiurim, but just briefly, the reason why it's so monumental, and in some ways the most monumental, is because at that point is when we officially, halachically became a nation. In other words, all the Jewish people converted at that point. They all went to mikveh. We all became converts to a new religion, essentially, Judaism. Till then, it was a bunch of individuals who all believed in the same thing. Now we became one unit, one nation, the chosen nation, given the Torah for a unique and distinct mission to fulfill God's will and to bring godliness into the world. And another reason why it's so monumental is because that is what our belief is based on. Our belief is not based on Moses. It's not based on a prophet. It's based on the fact that 3 million Jews saw God. Not one individual saw God and then told that to 3 million people and they disbelieved him. Rather, 3 million people saw God and they passed that on to future generations. And that's why the giving of the Torah in the year 2448 is perhaps the most monumental event. Now, what's very important, we see this again and again, but we see that there's like a plan and it sort of goes off plan. And this is again, when this is another example of when that happens. When the Jewish people received the Torah, they reached the ultimate spiritual perfection. In fact, it says that all the impurity which came on the world through the Chet Eitz Hadas, through the sin of the tree of knowledge, was removed by the giving of the Torah. When God descended on Mount Sinai, gave the Jewish people the Torah, the Jewish people reached such a state of perfection that if they would have continued that way, the world wouldn't have remained an evil place. It would have become like it was before the sin, before the first sin. However, it didn't quite end up that way. What happened? They served the golden calf. Right? They served the golden calf. What happened? What happened was that the world reached a state of perfection, right? And then the sin of the golden calf brought back all the impurity that was there before. It brought that impurity back into the world. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from the mountain, and he sees the Jewish people dancing around this golden calf. What does he do? He breaks the luchos. He breaks the tablets. When did that happen? It's actually very appropriate to the time that we're in now. It happened on the 17th of Tammuz, which was just last week. 17th of Tammuz, which has remained a sad day for other reasons, but that is when he broke the luchos and God was very angry and upset at the Jewish people. In fact, God says he wanted to destroy all the Jewish people at that point. Right. Only through Moshe Rabbeinu's prayer did God forgive the Jewish people, eventually. So what happened, in terms of historically, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from the mountain 40 days after the giving of the Torah. The Jewish people are bowing down to the golden calf. He smashes the luchos. He goes back up on Mount Sinai to pray for the Jewish people on the first day of the month of Elul, and he comes back down on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And that is when God forgave the Jewish people, and that is why Yom Kippur has remained since then a day of atonement. Now, what's very important to understand about this, this also gives us perspective about Jewish history in a number of ways. Because you need to understand, how many Jews do you think served the golden calf? All Jews served the golden calf? No. The woman didn't, first of all. Tribal Levi didn't. But not only that. It says in many sources, about 3,000 Jews. Out of 3 million. Right? Who were these 3,000? A lot of them weren't even proper Jews. A lot of them were just the Erev Rav, the people which like joined the Jewish people because they saw, they weren't converts. In other words, converts who are sincere, that's a different story. They were people who joined because they saw that the Jewish people are sort of, you know, this is a good group to join. You know, when you see a country being smitten with 10 plagues and you see seas being split, you say, oh, this is a cool group to join, right? They didn't really sincerely join the Jewish people. These people were continuously making trouble, and this is one of the times. And nevertheless, God was so upset at the Jewish people, almost about to destroy all of them. Why? Okay, a group of Jews did a bad thing. Why is it so monumental? Why is it so bad? And this also gives us something very important to understand. You know, just before we get there, you know, I heard once from the, I mean, it could be other people say this, also heard from Dennis Prager, who's a talk show host in America. He says like this, he says, one of the reasons why he believes that the Bible is written by God is because it makes the Jewish people look so bad. Think about it. If a Jew would have written the Bible, right, would have written the Chumash, would have written the Jewish history, wouldn't they want to make Jews look good? You want to fabricate? You wouldn't fabricate. You just miss out some stories, you know, the golden calf, the side, all the sins that the Jewish people did. But leave that out. We'll make the Jewish people look. Oh, the Jewish people, they're a great bunch, right? But it doesn't look like that. You go through Tanakh, the Jewish people are terrible people. Again and again and again, they sin, they rebel against God, they do terrible things. That's one of the proofs that's written by God. It's honest. It's honest criticism, right? Having said that, you know, this is a little bit extreme. You know, you have a small group of people. You know, what's the big noise about, right? So what's very important to understand is two things. Number one, we are, and this is again, I've said this many times, when we talk about the Jewish people being the chosen nation, it's not about us being better or worse. It's just about our mission, which we were given. We were given a very important mission, a fundamental mission that will fulfill the purpose of creation, to bring God into creation. If we don't fulfill this mission, the world will never come to the state of perfection. In other words, the world will never reach its purpose. So it's basically, we have an incredible responsibility. Responsibility comes together with incredible accountability. When you're very responsible for something, when you're in a position of power, you also should be held accountable much more than a regular person. Since we were given such an important mission, God, as you see throughout Tanakh, is incredibly harsh almost with the Jewish people, because we're expected to be much better. We're held to a much higher standard. Right? Even in a bad way, the world also holds like that. Right? The world, unfortunately, holds the Jewish people to a whole different standard. They think we should be, you know, saints. Someone's shooting at you, I shouldn't even shoot back. Okay, that's bad. That's ridiculous. But that comes from somewhere. Right? Every bad thing has its root in good things. It comes from the fact that we do actually have this responsibility to hold ourselves to a high standard. And when we don't, God deals with us incredibly harshly. And there's another very important point over here, and that is collective responsibility. The Jewish people are responsible for one another. There's no such thing. You're either part of the problem or part of the solution when it comes to Judaism. No such thing as being a bystander. When the Jewish people stood at Mount Sinai, we have what's called arvus. We are responsible for every single other Jew fulfilling their mission. As scary as that sounds, how can you blame me for what this person does? We're intertwined. We're all one entity. We're like one body, it says. And just like the foot is responsible for the hand, and the hand is responsible for the foot, and the head is responsible for the whole body, we are responsible to make sure that everybody else is also doing the right thing. And that's something which we see in an incredible way from the golden calf. What happens? Moshe Rabbeinu comes down on Yom Kippur. God forgives the Jewish people. And he gives them the command to build the Mishkan. Okay. Mishkan is also connected to the time which we're in. We're in the 3 weeks now, the time where we mourn the destruction of the temple. The Mishkan was the temporary temple, eventually became the temple. When the Jewish people went into the land of Israel, they built a temple, which was basically like the Mishkan. Bigger, greater, etc., more details, but based on the same plan. Right? What was the purpose of this Mishkan? The Mishkan is not just a side thing. Because from this point, we're right now, if you're looking in the Torah, we're holding Parshas Truma, which is in Shmos. It's like the beginning of the Torah. From here to the end, basically, it's all centered around the Mishkan. We have a few stories, but a lot of the laws are all centered around the Mishkan. Sacrifices, the way the Mishkan should be built, the various vessels, where the Mishkan was when they traveled, who should carry the Mishkan, why so much. Do you know, by the way, that now that we don't have a temple, we only have three, you know, we have 613 commandments? We only have 369 nowadays that we're able to keep. Out of those, most of those 369 are negative commandments. Things that we're not allowed to do. Things that we have to do, most of them we don't have. Because most of the things that a Jew has to do is connected with the Beis HaMikdash, connected with the temple. Why? Because, as we said, the journey of the Jew, the purpose of the Jew is to bring God into creation. That happened in the Beis HaMikdash. The temple, or the Mishkan in the desert, was the meeting point of God and earth. That is where God's presence was. In fact, it says in the Torah that a cloud rested on the Mishkan, representing God's presence being in the Mishkan. That was the revelation of godliness in this world, was through the Beis HaMikdash, through the Mishkan. So, we became a nation, we have the Torah, we have the Mishkan. What should be the next step in the journey? We should take this Mishkan and go to the Promised Land and plant it in its eternal place in Jerusalem. But that doesn't happen. That was supposed to happen. Again, a lot of things are supposed to happen, but it didn't happen. The plan was, the Jewish people, just again, historically, they were at Mount Sinai for around a year. At that time, they built, that was the whole golden calf, and Kippur, building the Mishkan, all of that happened then. They were going to travel straight from there to Israel. You know, you can, if you would walk from Sinai to Israel, it doesn't take 40 years. It takes a couple of days, right? And that's how much it should have taken. It should have taken 3 days. And that was supposed to happen, but it didn't. And that leads us to the next story, the story of the spies. Right? The story of the spies was a very tragic story. So the Jewish people are about to go into the land of Israel. They get a little bit scared. They decide, let's send spies, see what type of land it is. The spies come back with a bad report. When did this happen? On the 9th of Av, which is in a week and a half from now. The 9th of... Now, this is a very monumental event for a number of reasons. Number one, because of this, the Jewish people now spent another 40 years in the desert. But it wasn't just another 40 years. First of all, an entire generation died there. A whole new generation went into the land of Israel. Second of all, because of this, we'll come back to the spies in a second, but if you totally skip through the 40 years, you go all the way till the end, the Jewish people once again don't have water. And here we have the story of Moshe Rabbeinu hitting the rock. Moshe Rabbeinu hits the rock, what happens? The Jewish people don't have water. They come to Moshe Rabbeinu and they say, we want water. Why did you take us out of the land of Egypt to die in the desert? Right? You know, another nature of the Jew, which you see in the desert, which is not a positive one, is this like stubbornness and this like, you know, the inability to change one's opinion. They came out of Egypt. They said, you know, they had this notion that it was better in Egypt than in the desert. No matter what God did for them, it didn't help. He could bring down the mon and then the water and give them the Torah, and it didn't help. All right, the Jews are a stubborn nation. It could be used for good also, but in this case, it wasn't. Right? And they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, we don't have water. And they started complaining. And in a moment of almost weakness, if we can say, Moshe Rabbeinu gets angry. And he says, listen up, rebels. You know, can you think water can come out of this rock? He sort of... It's very hard to use such expressions about Moshe Rabbeinu. Obviously, there's deeper aspects to the story. But on a very literal level, he gets upset at them. And because of that, instead of speaking to the rock like God commands him, he hits the rock. And God punishes him that Moshe Rabbeinu as well dies in the desert and doesn't go into the land of Israel. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu not going into the land of Israel, by the way, is not only monumental for Moshe Rabbeinu. It actually affects the entire Jewish history. Because if Moshe Rabbeinu would have been the one to lead the Jewish people to the land of Israel, that would have been the final redemption. Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest Jew who ever lived, if he would have built the Beis HaMikdash, it would have lasted forever. The temple would have lasted forever. Whatever Moshe Rabbeinu built had to last forever. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't go in allowed room that 1,000 years later, the temple should be destroyed, and the second temple should be destroyed, and that's why we're still here. So the story of the spies, which then led the Jewish people to remain in the desert for 40 years, which then led the story of the hitting of the rock to happen, was a terrible story. When did it happen? On the 9th of Av. The 9th of Av has been a tragic day since. In fact, the destruction of both temples happened on the 9th of Av. I believe even first of all, the Spanish Inquisition happened on the 9th of Av. I believe World War I started on the 9th of Av, which eventually led to World War II, which is the Holocaust. No, we're talking about literally tragedies in history all started and had something to do with the 9th of Av. Because the spies is really what sort of changed the course, sort of, you know, stopped what was supposed to happen. The Jewish people should go into the Promised Land and be there forever. And that didn't happen, unfortunately. Right. So the Jewish people are in the desert for 40 years. Moshe Rabbeinu hits the rock. And then Moshe Rabbeinu passes away. right before Moshe Rabbeinu passes away, he gives a speech. It's a very, very long speech. It's a couple of, I think it's more than a month. And it's a very, very long speech. And it's the whole last book of the Torah. The whole last book of the Torah, Devarim, is Moshe Rabbeinu's speech. Then Moshe Rabbeinu, here, it should be here. Moshe Rabbeinu passes away in the year 2488. Yeah. 1272 BCE. Moshe Rabbeinu passes away and hands over the mantle of leadership to Joshua, to Yehoshua. Right. And now the Jews will go into Eretz Yisrael, into the land of Israel, and conquer the land of Israel, which starts a whole new chapter in Jewish history, which we'll do next week.